For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. Oh, so welcome to this chilly February day. I wanted to talk today about something that I have started to think about as the arsenal of compassion. And I especially, when that sort of phrase came to me, I especially liked it because I like the idea of mixing a word that's kind of associated with something peaceful and then a word that's associated with something a little bit more aggressive or warlike. And I've been thinking about this because of, you know, all of the polarization that is surrounding all of us in this, you know, political climate, within our environment, within the world around us. We are, you know, kind of right now steeped in sort of feelings of mistrust and despair and fear. And even though we may not all agree on what's wrong and how to fix it, I think most people are feeling a sort of a feeling of dis-ease. And, you know, one of the traditional Buddhist ways of thinking about dis-ease is, you know, suffering and relieving suffering, and that's part of our, you know, what we'll be chanting at the end of this talk and part of what we take on as a vow as, you know, in practicing Buddhism and Zen. But it's also, you know, there are spiritual figures within Zen Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism in particular who can guide us. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit today about that as we maybe think about, you know, how we can reconcile what may be, you know, necessary anger or protest or even force with Buddhist values, which are really a lot about, you know, bringing compassion to situations, relieving suffering, helping all beings. And so how does that, you know, thing that ordinarily feels very, very peaceful and nice, reconcile itself with sometimes, you know, the need for aggression or action. And so I started studying Avalokiteshvara, who is our Bodhisattva of compassion, who may point to some ideas about this and ideas that we can, you know, bring to our practice. So I am leaning very heavily on Taigen's book, Faces of Compassion, which is a wonderful book about different, I think seven different bodhisattvas and history behind each of them, but also how they, you know, different ways that they manifest in our modern world, whether it's in particular people who exemplify, you know, qualities of that bodhisattva, or using the paramitas, which are, you know, our Buddhist teachings about transcendent practices. And I started really studying Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, and I wanted to share you know, six or seven famous historical portrayals of Avalokiteshvara that might help us think about the arsenal of compassion. So Avalokiteshvara is known throughout different Buddhist traditions. In China, she in that culture is known as Guanyin. In Japan, this bodhisattva is known as Kanon or Kanzeon. In Korea, the bodhisattva is known as Kwanseum. In Tibet, he or she is known as Chenrezig. I think Tara is also a manifestation of the bodhisattva of compassion. And so the seven forms are in some respects very different, and I think that that's going to be important as we talk about it. The earliest form of this bodhisattva would be known as sacred or honorable Avalokiteshvara, previously, before we learned of the existence of other Avalokiteshvaras, it was just Avalokiteshvara. But this is a, you know, it's a human figure. So bodhisattvas are all seen as human embodiments, and this sort of, you know, human-looking figure holds a vase or a lotus in one hand, and the other hand is raised in a mudra of offering or allaying fear. So this very early manifestation of different ways that we can help others. We can offer things, we can allay fear, we can you know, give things like a vase or a lotus. The vase is used to pour either water or nectar, and something soothing, you know, and it's a nice image of ways in which compassion and feelings of relief can just flow to, you know, wherever they're needed, the same way that water will seek its level. And so that's maybe the form of Avalokiteshvara that comes to mind most frequently. And we have several examples around of different manifestations around the Zendo and around the center. We have an Avalokiteshvara right there. And that, is that more sort of the sacred? I can't see so well.
It's hard to see.
Yeah. Oh, that is an 11-headed. Okay. So, would this Guanyin be more of a sacred Avalokiteshvara image?
Yes,
yeah.
So it's one of the 33 forms riding on
a lotus leaf through the water, saving beings, going where they're needed. So, that's one manifestation. Another very famous manifestation, which Taigen was just referring to right here, although it's very hard to see, is 11-faced or 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. You may have seen this figure with a front head, but then there's a head on either side, and then you go up a level, there's a head, two heads, three, and then at the very top there is the head of Amitabha Buddha, or Amida Buddha, who really kind of gave birth to this particular bodhisattva. Now, on some classical images of 11-faced Avalokiteshvara, the front three faces are smiling kindly, you know, in a way that we think of as compassionate. But the left three are looking really wrathful and, you know, kind of angry and fierce. And those three heads are supposed to be directed at beings who require stern guidance to awaken. You know, when we think about being skillful with helping beings, we recognize that maybe some people need, you know, hey, what are you doing? Slap on the wrist to awaken, and maybe something a little bit more than a slap on the wrist. But you get my point. The right three heads have fangs to protect the faithful. So there are different, we can see from this figure already that compassion can take a multitude of forms depending on what's needed. And what's needed is not always, you know, the peaceful, nice, kind face. Although that is equally important, no less important. And so why 11 heads? There is a story. There are a couple stories about this. The most popular story, I think, is about the Bodhisattva of Compassion rescuing suffering beings from different realms of birth and death and into the pure land of liberation. And, you know, Avalokiteshvara would go back and get some beings and bring them across to the pure land of liberation, and then would look back and realize that as soon as they were bringing beings out of there, the spaces that were occupied with those beings would just fill right up again with more suffering beings. And so Avalokiteshvara's head kept splitting open from grief, just, you know, at seeing that as much as they were doing to help with the suffering, more suffering was coming right in to take its place. And I think we can, you know, we can all feel that way at times, that we can't do enough, and we wanna try to do more, or we feel despair that what we are doing isn't helping. And You know, so that's maybe a powerful image to take with us, that even the bodhisattva of compassion can feel that way and can feel the grief at, you know, there's more that needs to be done. A third manifestation of Avalokiteshvara is thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And this is one that you've maybe seen in different depictions. It's sometimes paired with 11-headed Avalokiteshvara, as it is on the very, very fragile statue in the Dokusan room that I didn't want to bring out because it really could break. But we do have sort of a representative on the altar right now, being represented with only four hands, in order to represent the multitude of possible hands and arms and eyes. And each of the thousand hands that is emanating off the thousand arms from Avalokiteshvara has an eye in its palm. And the eyes are a way for this bodhisattva, this manifestation of the bodhisattva, to see from all different perspectives. You know, if you have a hand over here and a hand over here, they're going to be seeing different things. And so it's a way of seeing immediately what's needed. And so, and they also hold many different tools. So, you know, the eyes, I think, can represent Avalokiteshvara's skillful means in observing beings in all their many manifestations and facets, but then reaching out a hand at the same time to assist them with whatever they happen to have in that hand as a tool. So I think this really can demonstrate for us, you know, the huge importance of studying situations and self and other in order to discern, you know, what's going to be helpful, what can I bring to this situation, and then just to bring it. Common tools that this Avalokiteshvara carries would be a vase, as I was saying earlier about the sacred Avalokiteshvara, which contains water or nectar to offer relief where it's needed. This manifestation might carry an axe, which is said to give protection against oppressive authority, which, you know, perhaps is also relevant. I have not seen one with an axe, unfortunately, but I have seen one with a bow and arrow, which maybe can do the same thing. This bodhisattva can carry a mirror, which signifies prajna or wisdom, or, you know, literally seeing oneself, seeing the fruits of one's actions. A willow branch, which will drive away sickness. A conch, which this particular figure on the altar is carrying, which is used to summon beneficent spirits. So, you know, if you're in trouble, you just blow the conch and spirits will come to help. You know, that we, maybe also suggesting that we can't do all these things by ourselves. You know, even a great bodhisattva needed to be able to summon, you know, other bodhisattvas to help. Other tools would include, you know, sutra books or vajras, thunderbolts, sun and moon figures, lotuses. That one has a lotus. A monk's staff, a hook, a club, a dagger, bow and arrows. Malas. That particular statue is also holding a mala. So there are, you know, practical tools, and then there are spiritual tools. And both, I think, can be very helpful in helping beings awaken, which is really the purpose. It's we are helping to save beings, and we're helping to relieve suffering. But part of that also involves helping beings to awaken. And so I think, you know, the multitude of tools that are available are, you know, they demonstrate the practical principle of just compassionately using whatever we might have to benefit beings. And so how can we bring this something like this to bear on our world today? You know, how can we know whether our actions are coming from a place of compassion and awakening, or whether they're coming from a place of fear and separation and closing down, you know? And I really think that is what our practice is all about. You know, we're observing and trying to relax with the situations around us so that we can see them a little more clearly. You know, when we're, I don't think, you know, compassionate, helpful, peaceful actions generally don't come from a mind of that's agitated. You know, when we're really agitated, it's really important, I think, to just, you know, sit down and quiet down and bring some whatever peace we immediately can to ourselves so that we can get a sense of, okay, what do I need to do in this situation? But maybe what we need to do in this situation is to, you know, use a bow and arrow or an axe or something that will skillfully help a situation. So, you know, I think it's also true that as this bodhisattva has, or as portrayals of this bodhisattva, maybe is more accurate to say, have changed over time and culture, you know, so do situations and the appropriate tools to impact them change across our time and across our culture. And so, you know, today we might have things like, you know, cell phones or, you know, ready video cameras to show, you know, kind of what's happening in our world, or ways to communicate much more readily to others so that others can, you know, wake up and recognize what's happening in our world. So we have a different range of things that are available to us to help, and it's important to you know, reflect on what those are and how we can use them as skillfully as possible. It's also, I think, you know, very important to cultivate qualities that are associated with Avalokiteshvara, and in the paramitas, those would be qualities like generosity. You know, Avalokiteshvara is all about studying a situation and trying to help, trying to offer some kind of comfort or remedy or correction, whatever's needed. So practicing generosity towards ourself and towards others is important. The thousand hands and eyes and tools, in particular, I think really demonstrate the paramita of skillful means, which is another, you know, transcendent practice that comes out of studying situations, where we think about, you know, how can we skillfully impact this situation? I'll get onto that in just a moment. Patience is another quality that is, you know, exemplified by Avalokiteshvara in terms of, you know, the kind of patience that's required to study what's going on, to sit with something long enough that we can gain a handle on it. Sometimes our first perception of a situation isn't always accurate because of lots of different factors. We can't see the whole thing. Things change over time. We maybe haven't had a chance to take stock of how our conditioning is causing us to see this situation. And so it really requires patience. And it takes patience also to develop the, you know, last quality of wisdom or prajna, which allows us to really be discerning and really be discriminating in what is most helpful and how we can be a part of that, or, you know, or leverage other people to be a part of that. So back to skillful means. You know, we're talking about, I think, you know, cultivating some peacefulness and ability to, you know, kind of sit with something in ourselves and the wish to help and generosity, and all those things sound very nice and peaceful, and they are. You know, it's not that they're not, but I think I really want to highlight another dimension of compassion, which is that compassion is not just being nice. You know, compassion is not always nice, because sometimes nice, just in the way that we think about it, It just doesn't work. And this brings us to the fourth form of Avalokiteshvara, who is known as horse-headed Avalokiteshvara. And I don't have an image, but it just sounds wonderful. This bodhisattva is described as a fierce, wrathful figure with three faces, six or eight arms, and has a horse head in his headdress. And this manifestation expresses compassion with an angry or terrifying image for those who need this to awaken. You know, sometimes we need to really be, you know, kind of brought down to the scariness of reality. And I think that this speaks to a key point that is sometimes kind of controversial, but I think that, you know, we've all seen this happen in different aspects of our personal life or the life in the world, which is that, you know, not everyone responds well to kindness or to our being nice or patient or polite. You know, sometimes we can ask for things as kindly and politely and assertively as we can, and it doesn't get anywhere. So to continue to practice patience or what we think of as compassion, it doesn't really get anywhere. You know, some people just will not even notice that we're practicing. You know, I'm practicing my compassion with you. And I think sometimes this turns into what Pema Chodron has referred to as idiot compassion. But when we're, you know, kind of trying to practice compassion and patience with people who are, you know, taking advantage of us or walking all over us, I remember I laughed out loud when I first read that in one of her books and was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that was kind of refreshing. You know, so some people are just not even going to notice because they're caught up in whatever is going on for them. And I don't mean this in a pejorative kind of way. You know, other people, because of their own past conditioning, will see, you know, their conditioning or their history will see this approach as weak and feel disdain and actively, you know, actively resist that. So taking this approach in some situations really helps neither ourselves nor anyone else. You know, there are times when for some people in some situations, maybe it is most compassionate to take a forceful, aggressive approach that, sometimes, you know, people need to be woken up with a scream. You know, you got to get people's attention before they can wake up. So, you know, an example would be needing to restrain someone physically or imprison someone in order to prevent them from harming someone else or harming themselves even. So it is sometimes necessary to bring something more aggressive or more forceful, and that person, you know, may not like it in that moment. And that's really hard. You know, I find that hard. As someone who does genuinely want to promote, you know, what I think of as values of, you know, actually being kind and being compassionate and being patient. So I think it's not something to take lightly, you know, and I don't mean it lightly. I think, you know, in our current political climate, for instance, maybe it is necessary to protest or to organize some kind of legislation or to outright fight. You know, sometimes that is the only way to get something to happen. And I just would say that, you know, I think it's important to do it skillfully, you know, from a place of study, from a place of studying our own motives, studying what we can about what the, you know, maybe it doesn't, maybe the other, maybe the motives of others don't matter. No, they do. They do matter. The effects of what is happening are hugely important. But I think it is also important to study the motives of ourselves and others so that we can understand how this situation came to be. You know, so because without understanding how a situation came to be, it's very hard to help. Because it's hard to figure out what might help someone else, you know, stop something that's harmful. So you know, I really can't tell you what is the most appropriate response for you. You know, I think we need all of the forms of Avalokiteshvara. And, you know, maybe we will each manifest different forms at different times. So I'm talking about, you know, some of these fiercer, you know, modes of Avalokiteshvara. There are two others who are, you know, kinder, gentler versions of Avalokiteshvara. There is, the Avalokiteshvara who's turning the wish-fulfilling gem. And, just a, you know, it's a gem that allows beings to just get what they want or what they feel like they need in any given moment. And sometimes that's the most compassionate thing to do in a situation. Just, you know, give someone something that they feel like they need or feel like they want. Number six would be Chunda Avalokiteshvara, who is known as the mother of Buddhas, and I think is also associated with Prajna Paramita, which is the paramita of prajna and wisdom, of transcendent wisdom going beyond. Both are kinder and gentler, and so we're up to six manifestations, and these are all joined in the end by a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara known as unfailing rope or lasso. And this manifestation embodies the bodhisattva's unfailing power of being capable of saving even the most difficult beings who are resistant to wholesome activity. And the way that unfailing rope Avalokiteshvara does this is by just tying them up. He just ties them up and carries them to the other shore of liberation, presumably kicking and screaming and, you know, not maybe being fully willing to go there. But, you know, unfailing rope gets the job done. And so as we think about, you know, how we can be in this world that we have right now, I think it's really important to study just the different manifestations of Avalokiteshvara and see, you know, maybe which manifestation or which quality would be most appropriate in whatever given situation that we are in. There are a lot of places in the Lotus Sutra in particular that talk about Avalokiteshvara, and one in particular talks about the Buddha wondering, you know, who's going to carry on my teaching in this future evil age that we're heading into, and suddenly springing up from the ground come, you know, thousands of millions of billions of trillions of bodhisattvas who spring up and say, hey, I'll help to preach the Lotus Sutra and help bring this, you know, to bear in this future evil age. And so I think this, you know, this is a nice image maybe to leave with, because I think this is, I don't know, probably every time, you know, up to the present and including the present, we have thought of as our current, you know, the future. We must be in the future evil age, and, you know, can it get worse? But, you know, if we are in the future evil age, our current situation, I think, is actually helping us to wake up. And you know, for better or for worse, maybe because things have gotten so polarized and so many people are in distress about the situation, whether or not they agree on what the situation is or why it's distressing, I think it's causing a lot of people to, you know, take notice and say, wow, you know, something has to change, and I don't know what it is. I don't think we always think so much about, you know, the manifestations of the things that we think that we're doing to try to fix what it is, but that's another piece of practice, you know, and I think it just takes patience to stay with this and practice and do what we can to calm our own agitation enough to be skillful, even if what we come back with is a little bit more forceful, or, you know, or a little bit more fierce. There's a big difference in fierceness that comes from a kind and compassionate place or, you know, coming from agitation and confusion. So, you know, I want to say that I think compassion doesn't ask us to abandon our own perspective in this, but just to suspend it, you know, just to hold our perspective and the other perspectives that we might encounter to just coexist. And, you know, as part of the sort of non-separation of self and other, recognize that our perspective is our perspective, you know, and it's not otherwise, but that maybe in suspending that for a time, we can understand more about other perspectives so that we can understand how situations came to be as they are. And I think that, you know, with this understanding, we can begin to trust that we will be able to use the tools at hand to affect change and help all beings. So I think, you know, that's my goal, and I hope that this has been helpful. I would encourage anyone to, you know, use this as a encouragement to practice with whatever you got, you know, and see how that is for each of us and how that maybe fits into, you know, a skillful way of trying to help in all of the confusion and aggression that's going on in our world. So that's really all I have to say. But maybe if people have comments or questions or want to have a discussion, we have a few minutes to do that. How many minutes? We have a few minutes to do that. So thank you. Yeah.
Enjoyed your talk very much.
Thank you.
Very much to the point.
Thank you.
Today, where did the concept, the other shore, come from? What does it mean, really?
Wow.
The other shore.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't know, but Teigen might, because he's much more of a scholar than I am, but... So in terms of where it came from, I think the other shore is supposed to be, you know, awakening or a more enlightened or awakened perspective. I think the idea, I will say that I think the idea of a shore that's not here is maybe a little bit misleading, because we can really only find that shore here, but I think it worked as a metaphor for moving from a state of confusion, delusion, being, you know, massively afflicted with greed, hatred, confusion, to a state that is a little more clear seeing.
It's not a complete escape.
Trying
to run away from the shore.
No, but the shore kind of gives you that sense that you are, doesn't it?
Add to that, there's the idea in early Buddhism of these two words, samsara and nirvana. So in samsara is the world of suffering that we're all in, and nirvana was this idea of initially of escape from that, of freedom from birth, rebirth, and being caught up in suffering, and it was seen as an escape early on. But then as the bodhisattva idea developed, the idea of universal liberation, of helping everyone awaken, which is the bodhisattva idea, then it was seen as the other shore is not somewhere else, that we practice the bodhisattva of compassion that Asian was talking about is not about escape from this world, but how do we bring these values into this situation? So nirvana was right in the middle of the world of suffering somehow. That's our challenge.
Yeah.
But the metaphor of the other shore still remains. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Hi.
Thank you for your talk. And I was just confused about bringing someone to the other shore who's unwilling to go there and using the unfailing rope to tie somebody up and take them there. Just in my experience, somebody who is in that state, I guess, of
Yeah, you know, I don't know how much we can do that, you know, because I agree with you. I think that has to come from that person. But I'm thinking more of the trying to help that person stop, at least in the moment, harming themselves. Or others. So not as a permanent, you know, solution, but just as a temporary, you know, okay, just stop. Yeah, yeah. Whether it's our job or whether it's our sort of sense that maybe that's the best thing to do in that situation. Even though we can't see to the end of the situation, and they may, you know, go back and do the same thing the next day. But can we help to at least stop something in the moment?
I have two points. One's more relevant and then one's sort of strange. So the first one was sort of in response to what you said. When I first came to Buddhist practice, I thought a lot of the concept of cessation was simply ending things, like ending suffering, ending the things that you don't want to deal with. And then as I've sort of studied that more, and partially through precept study, what I've realized is sort of like heat or magnetism are really powerfully violent and angry emotions, maybe that we experience with other people, they're like energy. And if you snuff that out, then you end life. And so when you have, and part of my own actual work in my job is, with physical aggression or viewpoints we don't like, if you just try and end them, it usually just throws fuel to the fire. But sort of like, I like to think in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, there's this scene where this Englishman who's trying to enter this martial arts tournament is harassing everyone on the boat. And so Bruce Lee sort of sizes up the situation and says, okay, well, I should do something. I shouldn't just let this guy, like, beat everyone up. So he walks up to the guy who's showing off and says, I know a way to fight without fighting. And the guy says, I don't believe you. That sounds ridiculous. And he says, well, I could go show you on that beach over there. And the guy says, okay. He says, you know, we can take this boat and we'll go over and I'll show you on the shore. And, you know, you might kick my ass, but that's okay. So then the guy gets into the boat and then he untethers the boat and lets the guy, you know, float off into the ocean. And Bruce Lee's, you know, laying on the boat. So, you know, I tend to think in those really powerfully negative situations, there's a way to transmute energy and disperse it. But also sometimes, you know, like, for example, with some students I work with, when they're really violent, you just literally have to get them to a room and lock the door and wait for them to burn themselves out. And that's, you know, that's not escapism. That's, you have to protect yourself first.
Yeah.
And then you can help protect other people. And then my second sort of strange point was I've been having, on a more increasingly frequent basis, very strange and figurative dreams directly pertaining to Avalokiteshvara. Well, 2 nights ago I had one where I was in a room and there was a full moon lighting up the room. And Mahatma Gandhi walked in the door and knelt down and said, you know, I'm going to pass away right now. And I was like, oh, okay, please don't do that. That's kind of weird. And then he knelt down in the moonlight and, like, disappeared. And then I, when I was younger, I used to have horrible nightmares about, like, spirits being in a room and being able to feel them but not see them.
Yeah.
So then I felt his, like, spirit floating around in the room, and I'm like, this is really getting kind of weird. So I opened the door to let him out, and then I started chanting the Tibetan generosity, om mani padme,
uh-huh.
until the feeling went away. And then just last night I had a weird dream where we were doing temple cleaning on a cliff, and Douglas handed me a bow and arrow and said I wanted to shoot an arrow into this canyon. And I said, oh, okay. But I looked, and there's a practitioner tending a garden at the bottom of the canyon, so I refused. And then when I went to pull the arrow, I couldn't pull the bow at all, and the arrow just fell down and it rolled off into the canyon. It's very
clever. Your dreams have a lot of skillful means. These do, at least.
Some bring Gandhi back when you
yeah, we do.
Yes.
But yeah, you're right, that sometimes just changing the energy in the moment, you know, just stopping a situation in the moment, we don't have control over what happens next, but it might give that other person time to, you know, pause and change something, you know, and that's sometimes what we need the most is just somebody to like press the pause button on a situation so that we can be like, oh, all right, yeah, whoa, what was I doing here? Why, you know, the way that we are in dreams sometimes where you wake up, you start in the dream and you're just like, what am I doing here? You know, so that's, you know, an important aspect of compassion too, just the ability to press the pause button, change something in the moment and let the future unfold in light of that moment. Sid.
Thank you for your talk, and especially thank you for ending with your comment that a really important aspect of compassion is to realize that our perspective is our perspective. For me, I'm always kind of at a loss for how to take compassionate action, which I think is very necessary without contributing to the polarization, because I think it's the oldest story on earth. For any group of people to say, God is on our side, we are Kanseon, mm-hmm. we are the horse-headed ones. It's
yes.
the same conversation
yeah.
that, you know, exactly the oppressors, as we call them, are having in their
mm-hmm.
quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one of my favorite, I think the most interesting part of Face of Compassion for me was seeing the relationship between Kanseon and Kanjuzai. Kanjuzai is the aspect of this being of compassion that looks within in the Heart Sutra to understand very acutely, understand very clearly the nature of oneself,
mm-hmm.
which goes hand in hand with outward action. And that's why I'm grateful that you ended with that, because I think that if we don't understand and deal with the violence that we enact on ourselves, and the aggression that we enact on ourselves, or the violent thoughts we have about other people, including the oppressors, then I feel like we instantly slip into the polarization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm glad for the practice and for the Sangha. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, you're kind of inspiring me to recall that I didn't talk much about compassion as existing outside of us. I talked mostly about, you know, ourselves and how we can work with compassion and what we can do. But you're reminding me that it is also really important to, you know, yes, study our perspective, recognize that that's just one perspective, but recognize that compassion exists outside of us. And that is another piece from the Lotus Sutra is the universal gateway of Kanseon Bodhisattva, in which we're reminded that just by calling on Kanseon Bodhisattva, we can, you know, get some relief, and anyone can. And it's not so much a, you know, that God is on our side or anything like that, but just that it's really important to recognize that we don't have the final picture on anything, that compassion itself is much, much greater than ourselves or our actions, as are so many other things. I think you're right that we can go down a very dangerous path if we believe too strongly in our own, you know, anything, our own perspective, our own power, our own ability to change, our own rightness. And so it's always important to remember that there's so much we don't know and can't perceive. And these qualities of, you know, patience or skillful means are really only intended to help us widen our perspective a little bit, but it's always going to be just our limited human perspective, no matter how long we sit. we can let a lot more room in, but we'll always have blind spots. So that's why, you know, maybe that's why it's good that, you know, none of us can do anything on our own. We need, you know, lots and lots of other people, other beings to, you know, be part of that. So partly as a way of checking, you know, our own power and our own forcefulness. So thanks for that reminder. Thank you so much. That's a great ending.
Thank you for the helpful talk.